So thank you for inviting me. So as I was getting dressed this morning, I said, wow, I'm talking to a crowd that I don't know about health care reform 2.5 weeks before the election. So I thought I'd put maroon on to really create a safe place for myself. But it really is an honor to be here. Now, I saw the name of the program, you know, how the healthcare laws are going to impact your business. Well, I hate to tell you that even the healthcare workers and national healthcare reform people don't really know how the healthcare laws are going to affect your business because there's so much unknown. So my goal today is to really give you some information about why we're in the situation that we're in and what healthcare is really trying to do to address it. So the big tagline here, and I'll let, I labeled it the bad, the ugly, and the not so good but improving, because I think that that's really what's happened in healthcare over time. But the next slide, you know, is no new news, right? It's financially unsustainable. We've been saying this since I was, you know, a young nurse, that years from now we are not going to be able to sustain. And now with what's happening with the baby boomers, there's 10,000 people turning 65 every single day. We know that it's not sustainable, and I'd like to go over some of the numbers and tell you why. So historically, if you look at it, when Medicare was implemented in 1965, it was for people over the age of 65. And the life expectancy at that time was 62. So it was really kind of an insurance package to really protect widows and those people who lived above and beyond 62. Well, in today's world, our life expectancy is 81. We have a 16-year gap and how we take care of these people that are entering into the time that they are eligible for Medicare. It's pure math if you look at what's happened in our country with our healthcare system. So in the next slide shows that in 1965, when the program was introduced, 11% of the federal budget went to Medicare. In 2011, it's 23% of the federal budget. Our Medicare spending in 2010 was $523 billion. In 2012, it's estimated to be $586. And by 2020, it will be $932 billion. If we look at the total spending, you know, we've talked about we've been reducing healthcare costs over the years, and that is true. In 2009 and 2010, we had the slowest growth of healthcare expenditures at 4%. But where was inflation during that time? At 2 and 3%. So healthcare is still outpacing the inflation. It's not sustainable. Our enrollment today for Medicare is 47 million people. By 2020, it will be 79 million people. And in order to sustain the Medicare program the way it is today, you need three workers to every retiree. Well, if we look at what's happening with our population, our next slide shows that as the population of Medicare recipients is growing, the number of healthcare or of people to support the Medicare population is decreasing. So the numbers are just not adding up to being able to sustain our healthcare system in any way. Medicare, as I said, will be going insolvent. We really do believe that by 2024, if we don't do anything, we will be totally insolvent in our ability to provide health care. And that's why I believe that even though we don't know everything that's going to be passed and how we're going to maneuver, the health care industry, the employers, are beginning to move. We are making changes in health care regardless. Health care reform started 4 years ago. And regardless of what rules or what laws were out there, we're trying to make a difference and create a different venue of how we administer health care. I want to talk a little bit about Medicaid, which is usually state and federally funded for the indigent, the underserved, and the vulnerable. And if we look at that program, it was really started as a safety net in our communities, and it only covered about 500,000 people, and the budget was less than $1 billion. Now, in 2012, we have 52 million people that are covered, one out of every five people in the country, and in some states, one out of every four people depend on Medicaid. The federal and state spending just on the Medicaid is $400 billion, and if we continue to administer it the way that we've been administering it, will double its cost by in the next 10 years. So if you look at where we're going to end up with Medicare if we do nothing and Medicaid, it's just numbers that most of us just don't really even know how to relate to. Next slide shows that the ugly thing about this whole thing is that we're spending more on Medicare and Medicaid than we do in our entire defense budget, and we know how large our defense budget is today. So if we look at from a United States spending, if you look at healthcare is 17%, it outspends education and pensions and welfare, almost everything else. If we look at it from a state perspective, healthcare is 31% of what the state spends to administer healthcare in our communities. So when we look at healthcare, first of all, we know that the numbers just don't make sense anymore. The population's grown, outgrown the dollars that were set aside. But the other thing that we've identified as healthcare workers and leaders is that there is a lot of inefficiency in healthcare. And, you know, I read a great story. How do you relate to lay people about why healthcare is just so difficult to administer? You know, and I was reading this article and it said, you know, healthcare is like trying to get six different pilots in a plane. They all work for a different company. They get paid differently. They get incentivized differently. And they all have different rules. And if you think about that, that is a great analogy about what healthcare is today. We have physicians that are independent. We have all kinds of different healthcare services that are administered by very different people. And the government and the insurance companies incentivize hospitals and physicians very differently. So in the 1980s, reform began happening, and we went to what we call in the healthcare industry a case payment. We get paid no matter what we do. When a patient enters the hospital, we get paid a set dollar amount, no matter if you're there for 10 days or 15 days. Now, there's a lot of nuances with that. But a doctor gets paid for every single time they touch the patient. So the incentives are very different. And that's been some of the problems in trying to get an organization and an industry to work together when the incentives are so polarized. So along with the complexity of administering these, you know, over the years, the government has imposed more and more regulations on healthcare, and the bureaucracy has gotten so overwhelming, and there is so much waste in healthcare today. It, you know, it rivals about $600 to $600 billion. And the next slide kind of gives you an idea of where those costs are. And I would say it's not because people are horrible. You know, I really had to think about that last line. Gosh, do I put that up there? Fraud and abuse, you know? Do I really want to talk about my industry that way? But the issue about the fraud and abuse is that the complexity and the rules about how we bill for things, sometimes people are committing fraud and they don't even know it. Now, the government just says ignorance isn't bliss, and we hold you accountable for that. But it really is. The administrative complexity of dropping just one bill for services provided to a patient are incredible. And I've been in the healthcare industry all my life. My whole family is physicians and nurses and everything. You know, I don't even know how to read a bill when I get it from a healthcare institution because there's just so many adjustments. There's contractuals. It feels like funny money. But we have failure of care of delivery. You know, the lack of coordination of healthcare. Healthcare is one of the last industries to really move into the electronic age. You know, we're not totally electronic, St. Joe's. There's hundreds of thousands of hospitals across the nation that are not. We don't have a good way to get information from one physician to another physician or even to another hospital. The way that we have patients coming in through our ER that are repeat patients, if they go today to St. Joseph's, tomorrow to the Med, you know, and then to another hospital, we have no good way of communicating. And so being able to really create a treatment plan for a patient becomes very complex. And we keep trying, we do a lot of over-treatment and inefficient care. The consumer is much more well-educated today. And when we talk about over-treatment, some of it is driven by the healthcare arena, defensive medicine, all those different things that drive that. But also the consumer comes into the doctor's office and says, I want an MRI, and this is why I want an MRI. So we have higher and different expectations by the consumer that also drives some of that over-treatment. But we all admit that the over-utilization and the waste has to come out if we're going to transform healthcare. So I want to talk a little bit about Texas, because I think it's important for all of us to understand what's happening in Texas. First of all, we have the highest uninsured population than any other state. Now, you know, we're probably the biggest, largest state in the union, but that's a pretty large number. 25 to 30% are uninsured. We have the largest number of Medicaid recipients among any other state. The reimbursement that hospitals, specifically hospitals, get on Medicaid is 52 cents on every dollar that we spend on cost. And an organization, I know you heard Kathy back, I believe, in May, that she talked about healthcare and she talked about St. Joseph's. You know, we're very committed to being a non-for-profit, faith-based organization that serves the underserved but also serves the greater community. So when our uninsured is at, it's risen from 7.8% to 9 to 11%. You know, those dollars of uninsured plus a large number of Medicaid patients where we're administering care that doesn't even cover our costs are significant challenges to us as a health system. The fastest growing population in Texas is uninsured, the underinsured. So people, in order to keep their health care costs down, and you probably know this as employers, you're offering higher and higher deductibles. Well, if somebody comes into the hospital and they have a $10,000 deductible, it might as well as be as not having any insurance at all. And also our issue that also affects California and Arizona, where I most recently was, is the undocumented and how we manage to care for the undocumented. The physicians, you know, are trying to make a living, and they've gotten used to a certain lifestyle. And as the reimbursement continues to fall for Medicare and Medicaid, there's more and more physicians not accepting Medicaid patients, which then creates that cycle of not enough care, not being able to sustain, because they just don't feel that they can sustain their practices by taking so many or a high percentage of the Medicaid population. Okay, so the not so good but improving. So what are we doing about all this bad news? Well, like I said, probably 4 years ago, the healthcare industry started saying, we can't continue this way. We need to do things. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about what's been happening across the nation, what are other health systems and physicians working on across the nation to create a much better sustainable healthcare environment, and what you all can do as employers. So the new strategies for managing the care is population management. And this is where we talk about how do we take care of the person from beginning to end, and I'll talk a little bit about that. Behavioral economics, you know, we're all human beings. We're affected by changes that we can create in our behavior that really will lead to better health care. How we need to use the role of the advocates, the healthcare advocates, and then continuity of care. You know, the difficult thing as we transition into all these areas that really will create a different healthcare market for us in the future is that, unfortunately, all these things that I'm going to talk about in a minute are unfunded or very limitedly funded. So healthcare organizations are trying to figure out, how do I live in today's world where the reimbursement is? And how do I move into tomorrow's world where it's really kind of shaky and there's really not reimbursement for it right now? So population management. When we talk about population management, we're talking about taking healthy populations, making sure that they're under a medical home. And we'll talk a little bit about what a medical home is. And that we're managing that patient through their entire continuum of care. When they're healthy and keeping them healthy, when they have at-risk comorbidities that we talk about, you know, risks that they have, how do we keep you well during that time? If you have an acute incident, how do we take care of you during that time and make sure that when you leave the acute care setting that we've got enough health care to make sure that we're not creating another problem for you and that you're not coming back and being readmitted with greater problems. So that's what we talk about, population management. And in communities and states, what they're trying to say is partner up with a payer, with a, you know, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, you know, whoever it is, and we're going to put dollars at risk, and we're going to pay you a certain amount of money to take care of a population. And the goal of the healthcare system is to try to keep those people as healthy as possible. So to what do we need to deploy to help those populations? So, for example, I don't know what St. Joseph's numbers are, but nationally, when a patient gets discharged after a heart attack and maybe needs to go see their primary care to manage their blood pressure and their medications and so on, it could be 3 weeks before you get into that doctor's office. Okay, well, 3 weeks have gotten by. You're not really sure that you understood everything that the nurse told you to do. You're not really sure how to take your medications. And guess what? You've gained 5 pounds of weight in those three weeks that you've been out, and you're back in the emergency room because you're, you know, retaining fluid. You didn't know how to take your diuretic. We see that more and more in the older populations, you know. So they don't know if, you know, the medicines that they were taking before they came into the hospital, if they should start now taking them with the medications they were discharged with. So the lack of coordination. So how does the healthcare system make sure that we provide through the whole entire continuum touch points for those patients and their families to make sure that we keep them as healthy as possible? A lot of work across the country, a lot of good work going on across the country on population management, and that's something that St. Joseph's is also starting to explore. If we look at the next line, we know that we have a public health issue with obesity across our country. If you look at all those risk factors, the cost, the risk that is it costs the most in providing health care is obesity, because it just creates so many problems in general for them. So that is really becoming a public, I mean, it is a public health issue, but unfortunately we tend to put all of the responsibility in the healthcare systems, and we can't do it by ourselves. So I think that, you know, the governor of New York that, you know, put the sales tax on Coke and things like that, I think unfortunately that is really where we're going to have to move to make sure that we're managing that issue and creating a healthier community. When we talk about behavioral economics, what we talk about is, okay, how do we incentivize? So healthcare systems are out there and they're being told, you will learn how to manage the population. You're going to control how they react to their healthcare. And I got to tell you, that's a daunting, daunting thing for a healthcare system. Today, you guys probably saw in the newspaper, Wall Street Journal and other newspapers picked up, that starting October 1st, we now get we get paid by pay for performance. Based on how well we administer health care, we either get penalized or we will get rewarded. And so it's not that we get more money, it's just the money that we've been paid, you know, all along is either going to be reduced or you're going to be able to maintain it. And so when they say, you've got to make sure that the patient doesn't get readmitted. Well, okay, we're healthcare workers. We're working within the four walls of our organizations. Well, now we're being asked to, how do you extend out there? How do you create that? And behaviors of people around healthcare and many different things are difficult to regulate. I mean, it's just not something that you can regulate easily. So there's this whole phenomenon around behavioral economics. How do you create rewards for people to stay healthy, to be incentivized? And so, you know, there's cash rewards. Employers are doing a lot of things. You know, for example, if you're a non-smoker, we'll take, I don't know, $10 off your monthly payment of what you owe for your insurance coverage. You know, if you do an assessment, a health assessment, you know, with Cigna, whoever your insurer is, we identify what your risk factors are, and we are communicating on a regular basis things to decrease those risk factors. So mine is stress and lack of sleep, like probably many of you. You know, when I was at Crown de Lade, every month I'd get these little, you know, reminders, or am I getting enough sleep? What am I doing to reduce my stress? You know, so we can begin to educate the population of what kind of responsibility they have for their health care. recognition. I think people love to be recognized and, you know, and be rewarded for things that they've done. Competition, a lot of companies, a lot of healthcare systems have competitions going on. Who can lose, you know, the most amount of weight, or who can, you know, improve a health, you know, health risk the most. And then really getting to the pocketbook. How do we make it maybe better for those who are healthier, so we decrease your insurance? Or how do we put a tax on those people that are unhealthy and causing an employer to pay out more because that person is sicker, having to see seek health care much more? So, you know, the cost of a benefit is also looked at. And then at the end, you know, being healthy until the end of time, and, you know, having a healthy well-paced life without a lot of comorbidities. We know that is important, that as you as employers know that the number one and number two influencer on healthcare matters are your family, usually the female of the house, the household, but also the physician. The physician really influences and is an advocate. People tend to listen to their physicians if their physicians spend enough time with them and communicate what are the pros and cons. And so we're trying to figure out in health systems, how do we use the family, how do we use the physician to really influence how people go about their health care needs. When we talk about the continuum, that whole thing about population management, when we talk about a medical home, you know, many people don't have a primary care physician. People sporadically only go to the doctor when they need it, when they are really sick. And so in this new world about keeping people as healthy as possible, we talk about a medical home, a person identifying a physician who they're making sure that they're seen on a regular basis, that they're being maintained, that their risks are being managed, and that's what we talk about. Now, what we know is that 40% of the people that need health care don't have a primary care physician. And what we're seeing now with urgent cares and express cares and even in our own health system, we're seeing that people tend to go to the express, that's their primary care physician now. So how do we change how we deliver health care to create kind of a medical home within the express care if that's really where the consumer is going to go seek their care? We're trying to figure that out. We don't have all the answers, but we know that that is part of the issue. A team approach to care. So how do we coordinate handoffs? We know that there's horrible handoffs between a primary care and your cardiologist or your oncologist, or if you're a cancer patient, your medical oncologist, your radiation oncologist. Healthcare has just never been very good at doing that, and making sure that physicians and other healthcare workers are talking about the care that's being administered. And electronic medical health records will help tremendously, but how do we do that in an age where we're not totally there yet? Coordinated and integrated care, again, basically what I talked about. And the other thing is that quality and safety. You know, there is a tremendous amount of work that has come out of medical and nursing and social work about what we call evidence-based medicine. And how do we get an organization, a community of healthcare workers that has constantly been in defining that health is an art yet also a science? How do we get people to really focus on delivering evidence-based medicine? Because you'll have older physicians say, people are trying to make me practice cookie-cutter boiler-type medicine. I'm an individual. My patients need individual care. Providing evidence-based medicine doesn't mean that it's a cookie-cutter way of providing health care. We just know that there's certain things that need to be done in certain arenas of health care and different disease management that we should all be doing the same thing, and we should be expecting the same thing for our patients. Access, we know that we need to provide better access. We need to get to where the consumer is. And if healthcare doesn't do it, there's disruptive technologies and, you know, the Targets and the Walmarts of the world who are saying there's a lot of money in healthcare and they're not doing it very well. So we need to really understand how the consumer wants to get their healthcare and begin to create that access in a more deliberate manner. And then payments, and that started October 1st for us. You know, it's not that, you know, hey, we provided the service, so we have to get paid. Now the incentive is, what kind of quality did that consumer get from your healthcare system, and that we will pay based on the outcome. So I want to just share a couple of points. The American College of Healthcare Executives is the national organization for healthcare executives, and their statement on the position on healthcare reform and healthcare for tomorrow, I think really creates a basis of what we really need to do. You know, whether or not we believe everything that is in the Affordable Care Act, you know, that can be debated in another area. I definitely don't want to debate that. But we do believe that there are things that, in general, both at the federal and at the state level, that the Affordable Care Act does denote that we need to implement. If we're going to transform, it cannot be business as usual. So we believe that that needs to happen. But we believe that no person should be denied the necessary health care that they need. We as a nation need to make sure that people get the health care. It is what will make our community stronger in the future. Access to care is a shared responsibility. It's not only the healthcare organizations that are responsible for that, but the government, agencies, community groups such as you, and private insurance own that if we're going to have a strong, healthy community. And the law is not perfect. We know that there's a lot of debate. We all believe that that healthcare needs to be transformed. We just don't all agree on how it needs to be made. But we need to continue to work, and patients or consumers need to be responsible for their health care. For many years, we just, me included, we haven't taken responsibility for our health care. So patients, the providers, the insurance companies, and the government need to increase access, improve quality, and we do need to totally change our cost structure in health care. The six steps on an external standpoint, like I was saying earlier, the federal and the state do have to create access to the Affordable Care Act. Now, you know, Texas, like many other states, are opting out of the option to cover more of the Medicaid population, so we'll have to see how that turns out for Texas. Implementation isn't possible without the support through an entire community. Other providers, local governments, businesses, community organizations will be key to a successful implementation. Internally, what we're doing is that we're working every day, every moment, every waking and every moment that we're asleep, trying to work with our physicians to really create a relationship that creates a vision that is congruent and that is not polarizing. We are looking at true partnerships, and I think that physicians are starting to get there. I know that the younger physicians that are coming out of school today have a different mindset. My son is a third-year medical student at Vanderbilt, and even just the conversations that I have with him versus my father, who's a retired physician, are light years away on how medicine should be practiced. Continued enhancement of patient safety and quality, we owe that to our communities. People want to feel safe and that quality is being provided, right? You assume that quality, once you walk in the doors of a hospital, that quality is there, and we need to live up to those expectations. And again, cost continues to come up.